So yesterday, ARK Invest and Mark 33, who I'm going to introduce you to today in case you don't know them, dropped their paper or their study on SpaceX and gave us what they deemed to be its likely valuation in 5 and 10 years' time based upon current business model, their current business plans. And I have to say, it kind of, my hair stood on end. Well, not exactly, but you get the picture. I mean, I won't reveal all right now, except it's an incredible valuation. And for a company that's already valued at $350 billion, it's an amazing find. And so I'm going to ask these guys to explain themselves, and I won't call it justified because I've read this paper and I really have to agree with most of its findings. I have very few questions. I'm going to ask those questions of these folks. But let's start by introducing everybody. Let's start, Aaron, you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, I'm the founder and CEO of Mach 33. We're a research-led financial group, and I'll pass it over to Vlad.
Yeah, I'm associate Mach 33. I head the research, and this has been a long time coming, this model and this study. I got started on it maybe around a year ago. We were building up data sets and trying to project where SpaceX is heading, and we were lucky enough to partner with Sam and Daniel, who really took it to the next level starting a few months ago. On that note, I'll let them introduce themselves.
Sam, do you want to head up the ARK team?
Sure. Sam Corris here. I direct our autonomous tech and robotics research at ARK. And Daniel, take it away.
Yep. Thanks for having us on, Larry. I'm Daniel, a research analyst on ARK's autonomous tech and robotics team.
And so then, Larry, quickly here before the big reveal.
Yeah.
Are we, from your opinion, over, under, or spot on?
Yeah, I have some questions in the out years. I think you're a little, I think it's a little speculative. So it's neither it's neither over or under, but as we have to say about any study that goes beyond 5 years, the variables are just, explosive at that point. And so it's very difficult to really have a lot of confidence, particularly in this case. But I think the next 3 to 5 years, I think you're right there. I have a question, but I'm going to reserve it. But so I think the work is very good, Sam.
You want me to do the kind of intro to how this whole thing started?
I do, and I want you to talk a little bit about Mach 33, Aaron, because we really need to know a little bit about them. I think everybody knows a lot about ARK.
Yeah, so I would say this whole thing, kind of the genesis, is probably about 2 years ago. I was invited to join the ARK brainstorm. Larry, you're a guest there as well. And really just focusing on space. But really our genesis starts 5 years ago. We focused on space. We look at space as the next industrial revolution. And so Mach 33, I mean, the whole idea of Mach 33 is that it is escape velocity measured in Mach. And so we are pretty excited about what that's going to hold for the future of humanity. And so a lot of our frontier technology research and investments really center around space as the center of gravity, for lack of a better pun. So with that in mind, when we, I was reading one of ARK's, great Tesla models, and I don't know if it was an epiphany or whatever. I said, we really need this for SpaceX because it is the largest private company. It's really changing the way private markets are done in addition to, space itself. And so there's a lot of conjecture out there. And I said, I think there's an opportunity for us to really kind of shed the light of where this is going. Because you see all sorts of people investing in SpaceX with a variety of different mentalities on where it's going. And there's all sorts of just conjecture out there of what the value is and what it isn't and all that stuff. So we felt like it was a good idea. I ran it by Sam and the ARK team, and they said, awesome. And we dove in, and Vlad spent a ton of time on our end, really, we tend to focus bottoms up on our analysis just because we like the details and we're those types of people that maybe optimize to the nth degree. And so when we took it to ARC, a lot of what we were doing was putting a lot of time and effort into trying kind of make this something that can scale. It can be a model that kind of builds out several years and makes sense and isn't just, you know, super focused on tiny little variables. And it's gotten a lot better in just the last few months as we've been working on it.
Great. And just before we get to the detail with Vlad, maybe Daniel, you could give us the top line or the bottom line really on what the model is going to tell us. You know, what are we looking at in 5 years time? What are we looking at, you know, in 2040? What are the probabilities of this? Well, I guess Vlad will talk about the probabilities, but give us the bottom line,
sure.
Daniel.
Yeah. So maybe I can describe and explain to viewers what a Monte Carlo is, and that's essentially what this model is. It's a statistical method to model uncertainty and risk as it relates to forecasting, and I think it's best explained using an input. So in the model that we'll discuss in a moment, we have 50-ish variables, and of those, 17 are quote-unquote Monte Carloed. And what this means is, rather than relying on a fixed value, you essentially define a probability distribution, and then it'll randomly pick on that distribution to simulate a wide range of outcomes. So to take one of the variables as an example, the cost of Optimus in 2026, on average, we think it could be just over $100,000. 70% of the time, we think it could be between $75,000 and $125,000. And then the remaining 30% is outside of that range, but it never exceeds $250,000 or falls below $50,000. And the beauty about the Monte Carlo analysis is that if you disagree with any of those inputs I gave, you can look at our model and change them as you wish. And then you can see the implications to the price target. And to get to the bottom level, how it works is it runs said simulation for 5,000 times and picks random points on the probability distribution. And then we take the average of the 5,000 simulations, and then that gets us to our base price target. Our bull price target is the 75th percentile, and our bear is the 25th percentile, meaning there's a 25% chance that it's a given value or less, and by default, 75% or more. And I think maybe best to illustrate this can be Vlad. I know Mark put together great dynamic visualizations of our price targets.
So Vlad, could you give us a sense of what these outputs look like?
Yeah, so like Daniel just very elegantly explained, you've got these 17 independent variables that we set a range for. So, you know, we don't know what they're going to be for sure, but we can say that they're within a certain range. And what the Monte Carlo does over thousands of simulations, it randomly picks, and all of those permutations between those 17 independent variables all produce a valuation each simulation. Now, after however many thousands of simulations, we can plot where each valuation lands out of the total. And so right here, what you see on the left of this chart is the 2030 valuation probability distribution. So what we see here is the lowest that it could be, there's only a 0.8% chance that it's half a trillion and very quickly or rapidly rises. And up here, we've got 20% chance of it being 2 trillion. Tails off down to 7 trillion, 0.1% it being 7 trillion. So all of these obviously sum up to 100% probability. And so this shows the distribution of where we think SpaceX will go according to the model and according to the range of Monte Carlo inputs we chose. Now, we didn't put this chart over here because we're disorganized or crazy. The reason is that I can then plot the 2040 valuation distribution. And I purposefully made it red so you guys get the idea that it includes Mars. So what's super interesting is that obviously this distribution is very narrow. And what that represents is more certainty. So in the near term, the variables that go into it, we're more certain about what those variables will pan out. And the reason that is because of historical data and because the things we're tracking are happening right now. So number of launches, how fast the turnaround is between each launch, things like that. Then we go over to Mars, the distribution is a lot wider, significantly wider. And there's this really interesting tail out here. Wider distribution means more uncertainty. So you can see that, you know, 0.1% chance it's 5 trillion in 2040. Well, that's rounded down to zero, but 0.1% chance is 30 trillion. That's obviously a massive range. And that just reflects because that reflects the uncertainty in you know, projecting something as crazy as Mars. That being said, it does give you a directional estimate of where we're heading. So in this curve and this curve as well, the base case is basically where the peak of the curve is, roughly. So 2 trillion in 2030, it's actually 2.5 trillion, so somewhere around here. And then we had 12.8 for the middle of this curve. So these are kind of the best ways to show the outputs of the Monte Carlo. I think a lot of models that don't use a Monte Carlo, you have a fixed output. So it'd be maybe one of these points because we had to pick assumptions rather than inputting ranges. Yeah. But because we were able to input ranges and as a result, able to show the distribution of outcomes.
And Larry, I'm going to interject real quick. I think one valid question that people should be asking is why would you even include Mars? Because it's so hypothetical. Exactly. It's so hard to understand. And this was, I don't know if I was the only champion, but I definitely was one of the bigger champions. I felt like it was very important for that conversation to be had. It's obviously far out. We have no clue how this actually evolves, but Elon has said that he plans to put a lot of mass on Mars. He's not thinking about it seemingly from like an investment return perspective. He's thinking about it as a, you know, saving humanity perspective. But if that happens and, you know, you can trust what he says, which I believe we can, and might take a little longer, but we can trust it. What I think it's important for people in general, the investment community, to be thinking about what kind of investment value is there for Mars. And there's really no one's taken a stab at that. Everyone kind of hand waves that there's no potential return. I think that's wrong too. The return is really far out. No one really knows what it is. It's hard to model. It's hard to do risk analysis. But at the same time, understanding that there is historical precedent for companies to be formed when large exploration is being done and, you know, resources are being, you know, taken under company controls with like the, you know, the discovery of the new world, so to speak. And some of those companies that came, that Dutch East Indies, that someone correct me, I'm not sure if that was one of the name of the
Dutch East India Company.
Yes. And there's several of them.
And I have a very interesting story about that, but I'll hold it for the moment. Yes.
But, you know, the point stands. I think it's important that we as, you know, a group, you know, ourselves, but also the larger investment community, take this as a potential because it is. And oftentimes people like to just hand wave it as if it's just a science experiment. And ultimately it won't be. If there are 10,000 or a million people on Mars, there's an economy developing there. And what is the value?
And also just shooting for Mars has made SpaceX what it is, right? It's like you go back and everyone said, well, it doesn't make sense to have a propulsion landing system for reusability because you're sacrificing payload. And it's like, well, maybe that's the case, but that doesn't work if you want to get to Mars and come back.
Yeah.
And so, you know, one, no one's catching rockets with helicopters and parachutes. And SpaceX is the only one that is successfully reusing orbital rockets commercially. And so even just striving for this goal has been what's made SpaceX such a leader in the world today.
Well, that's what's so unique about this valuation, because the valuation includes an existing and business that we can materially value using standard measurements. But it's also looking at Elon's, you know, vision and attempting to add some number to that vision. That's extremely interesting. And that's why I was so taken with it. I was very taken with the number that you come up with for 2030. But of course, I was very interested to see somebody actually doing the work on Mars. So Aaron, I absolutely agree that that's a very critical understanding. Yeah, so we have kind of the best of both worlds here. We have, you know, a relatively robust short-term 5-year view, but we also have this, you know, Imagineering going out, you know, to the 2040s and beyond. So it's extremely interesting.
And so, Larry, I'll just add in something there quickly. We could have extrapolated the model even further. In fact, in the original draft, we went to 2050. It's just this effect that you see here, where the further you go in time, the wider the distribution gets. Yeah, as you can imagine, the 2050 one is an even wider distribution.
Yeah.
To the point where it makes 2030 a blip. And so if we'd showed you what the model says for 2050, you wouldn't even be able to see a 2030 distribution. It would just be a straight line somewhere around here. So that's just to show that, as you were saying when we originally started talking, that the further you go out in time, there's just naturally more uncertainty.
Yeah, and the level of uncertainty at 2040 already is so incredibly high that this is interesting from a, you know, from an perspective analysis, and as we get closer to it, we can start sharpening it and sharpening it and sharpening it. So it's a great beginning, and I really appreciate that. So now I'd like to actually turn to, you know, the actual model logic. You know, what is the plan? What is the business plan for the next 5 years? And then what is the business plan for Mars? That's where I'd like to go with this.
I'll take this one as Daniel sorts out the internet. But this is the highest level flywheel, which is really, what is the SpaceX business? You take cash, you turn it into rockets and satellites, and those you launch up, and that gives you bandwidth capacity in the form of the Starlink network. And then you get customers to pay for that. And what they pay goes back into that original cash pile. And then you spin this flywheel. And as you're spinning it, you're siphoning off cash that's going towards Mars development. And then as you do this, you know, Mars window's coming, you know, every couple of years, and you're sending stuff there. You're building out infrastructure with Optimi and other tooling of your choice. And then at a certain point in time, you've likely saturated the market for bandwidth. We think this is probably out in the 2035 to 2038 timeframe. And then what do? You say, okay, we're going to maintain the constellation because these are in low Earth orbit, so constantly falling out. So you'll need to send some up. But then otherwise you're like, let's just take all of this cash and send as much stuff as we possibly can to Mars so that we can have a colony there that is self-sustaining.
And that brings the next part of the plan, right? Mars. So I guess the next slide.
Right. And so what do you do on Mars? Well, that's a complicated question. So we decided to simplify it as much as possible. You're going to launch Optimi and Material. They're going to build out lots of infrastructure, and we're going to credit SpaceX with the book value of what they build. Vlad, I don't know if I'll pass it to you here, because Mach 33 has done a good, more detailed, I'd say high level order of magnitude look at, okay, if you're not just sending Optimi, like what is the materials you're sending? What do you need for a human to live on Mars?
Yeah, and so we attempted to do an analysis of an order of magnitude estimate of what you would need to send if you were to start operations on Mars. And while that's a useful exercise to a certain extent, and I forget the exact number we got, but it was nowhere near as high as legacy NASA studies. Part of that reason is much lower cost per kilogram, but also just that technology has evolved ever since then. We have certain kinds of technologies that we can send over that make us more self-sufficient, let's say 3D printers, or even small, you know, SMRs, nuclear reactors. Those are being mass produced now. They don't have to be built on a multi-hundred billion dollar budget by NASA. So, you know, those are a couple of examples. So we tried to do that analysis to a to an order of magnitude. That being said, what we did in this model was we made that a Monte Carlo input. So we got a general anchor point based on the Mark 33 analysis, but in the model itself, that's one of the input variables. So, you know, each you saw the distribution earlier for Mars. Part of the reason there's uncertainty is we don't know what the cost of the cargo is going to be and how much of it we'll need. And so we left that to the Monte Carlo. We said what we thought would be a reasonable range. I think the other side of that coin that I'm going to pass over to the art guys is why we picked to express productivity on Mars in terms of Optimus robots. So, you know, high level, it's a figurative estimate. You could have humans, but yeah, Daniel or Sam, one of you guys, do you want to explain why we picked Optimus instead?
Yeah, well, I mean, number one, Elon seems to have made that pretty clear in his tweets that this would be a sensible first thing to send there. And then I think it is going to be, one, extremely high risk to send a human. So why not send a robot? And if the robot can build or help build the infrastructure for humans, then that's even better. And in the most recent Mars talk, right, Aaron, you know, you brought up this point, right? It's maybe the first thing that all the Optimus has to do at first is build out some landing pads, and you increase the probability of successful landing by whatever percent, and that's alone is worth it as a initial payload.
I think one of the principal objectives of getting Optimi to Mars is to avoid the necessity of return journeys in the early years. Mm. I think that has the biggest advantage because that drops the cost and drops the risk and brings the future a little bit nearer. I think that would be the principal driving force. I mean, all the things that the Optimus does, the humans would have had to do. So Optimus by itself doesn't give us a value add. What gives us a value add is not having to protect or return those humans, or, you know, so.
Right. It's a game of mass. It's a game of mass. And I think this is true across space and aerospace, more so with space, right? It's like you send an Optimus, you don't need to include all of the things that would be required to keep a human alive. And that's a huge allotment of mass per the work that Vlad has done. Right. And then same thing, right? We're seeing it with the drones and aircraft now too. It's like, if you take what would need a human and you need to put it in a fighter jet, well, that's quite an expensive fighter jet. But if you make it so that it's autonomous or just a drone, well, the mass needed collapses.
Yeah. Yeah.
And just a quick interjection here, this whole idea that robotics is an AI driving robotics to be able to do a lot more is part of why we're excited about space, you know, and expansion. This is an enabler. The technology here is an enabler for making Mars far more realistic and building out basic infrastructure, landing pads, or setting up some of the initial solar panels and things like that. So, like, I think that's another reason why, kind of coming back to my point, right, which is I don't want to beat a dead horse here, but like Mars is far more realistic than a lot of people will give it credit. And one of the main drivers is robotics, AI, and we're kind of seeing the convergence of those two technologies. And I think Mars is a huge beneficiary of that.
And do you think, Sam, that this was one of the driving forces behind Elon's decision to get into the Optimus business, into the robotic business?
I don't think it was the driving decision, but I think it's all connected. Part of this, yeah, it's all part of the same puzzle, right? What is Tesla? Tesla's an embodied AI company.
Yep.
Robots are embodied AI. And it's like, I wouldn't even say that Tesla is the only company here that's going to play out on Mars. Absolutely. Right? Boring company, clearly, you know, Optimi operating boring companies to create, you know, habitats underground on Mars seems worthwhile. And then I don't want to sidetrack from this conversation, but I do want to, you know, we look at these charts here, and if you just go back to the Earth one, Vlad, it's so simple and so pretty. But that really takes away from the trenches of Excel that Daniel and Vlad were battling through. And so maybe Daniel, if you just want to go through quickly, right? It's to make a model that actually works here and looking at where the cash goes, right? Like what type of trade-offs were you and Vlad looking at?
Well, can I just say that Daniel really added a lot of value here because he made it so rigorous in terms of the accounting that even I couldn't believe it. So yeah, please go ahead, Daniel.
Sure. So
he is an accountant.
Yeah, I'm an accountant by trade, so I have to stick to my roots. Sure. So like Sam says, this is like an elegant, simple diagram and it summarizes a high level, but there are a plethora of considerations that this doesn't capture. For example, you need to kind of consider, okay, how many rockets are in inventory? Do we have enough cash to satisfy the needs of those? If we do, okay, let's build more rockets. If we want to build more rockets, you know, what rocket should we build? Is Starship ready? Is Starship ready? Yes or no? Okay, if it's ready, can it be reused? Yes or no? And then you have to get into the accounting of that. You know, if it's reusable, what portion of it is reusable? And then further complexities on like, okay, there's customer launches. What percent should we dedicate of our launches to customers versus continuing to grow the Starlink constellation? And with all of that comes like a lot of permutations and complexities. But Vlad, if you go to the next chart, the bandwidth metrics, I think this kind of is a bit more granular, but still summarizes just one further down. Still summarizes the high level of how we get there. So what this looks at is to the point of, is the constellation complete? This is a graphical representation of when it's complete. And to Sam's point, it's like 2035 to 2038. The purple line here kind of looks at the additional revenue SpaceX can get from launching a satellite. The green line here is the cost associated with launching said satellite. So you can see it kind of converges to close to parity, i.e. it's not worth sending an additional satellite because it's costing the same. And then at that point, the bandwidth just plateaus. And to Sam mentioned earlier, okay, bandwidth plateaus. We're just going to send up the amount of satellites that are being deorbited, and then we're just going all in on Mars. You know, take all of this cash that we're getting from Starlink and drive this interplanetary travel. And I think from an in-the-trenches perspective, this is where a Monte Carlo analysis is great, because I think a common theme we're touching on here is uncertainty and risk. And that's the whole point of a Monte Carlo. It's like, the space industry it's hard to compete with space when it comes to uncertainty and risk. So I think that's why it's kind of an appropriate way to do it. And yes, there's a lot of kind of unknown, but it tries to capture it to the best that it can. Go ahead, Sam.
Oh, I was just going to say, I think one of the most interesting things, right, you know, they say, no model is right, but some are useful. And it's like one of the most interesting things along the way was what Daniel was saying is like reusability and bandwidth. And it's like, okay, if you've got 10 starships and they go from being not reusable to reusable, then all of a sudden your cash needs change dramatically.
Yeah.
Because if they're right, and it's like, okay, first you go through and you're like, okay, right, of course, right? Fewer rockets or rockets reusable, you're just thinking rockets. And then you're like, oh no. It's like if they're gonna utilize these rockets to be sending satellites, and then all of a sudden you have a Starship that can be reused twice or three times a day, and then it's like the amount of cash you need to have in order to make enough satellites that can be launched on that rocket really is dramatic.
Yeah. What's interesting, I think if you go to the
Daniel,
I was just going to say, if you go to the next, or skip one down, Vlad.
Skip that
one. The marginal cost chart. Yeah, this one here. This kind of captures what Sam says. So, you know, in the initial years, as Starship isn't as rapidly reusable as maybe SpaceX would hope as they're going through different variations, over time, when they achieve that rapid reusability, you can see the bulk of the cost is satellites. And to Sam's point, like, you can launch X amount of times with a given Starship, but that Starship has to have satellites in it every single time it launches. So there's only so much that can write down in terms of proportion of the cost. And that was like an interesting finding for us. And like a derivative of that is, okay, if satellites are going to be kind of the most sensitive as it relates to cache, then we have to look at satellite performance, because that impacts how much bandwidth you can get into to orbit, as well as, okay, how much does it cost to get that bandwidth into orbit?
How did you model the satellite bandwidth improvement over time?
Sure. This is a great question. Yeah. This is a question that's up for debate amongst the community. Sam, you've done most of the work here, so if you want to take it, but you can see this elegant chart that Sam has put together on Wright's Law.
Sure. And I would say Wright's Law applies to a lot of space. And so for everyone who wants to hear me say it again, what is Wright's Law? It's for every cumulative doubling, you get a fixed percent cost decline. And so this actually, you know, the reusability of Falcon 9 has followed a Wright's Law curve, which is pretty remarkable. The cost of bandwidth in orbit has followed a Wright's Law cost decline curve, also impressive. And then here, we're just looking at the Starlink performance, which through the first four iterations of data that's semi-widely available, you know, you scrape from various reports, it's in FCC filings, it's in the reports that SpaceX puts out on their updates. And there's a pretty solid Wright's Law curve through Starlink V2 mini optimized. But then there is confusion at the end of 2024, because in the filings, SpaceX says their next generation satellite will weigh 2,000 kilograms or have a max weight of 2,000 kilograms. Normally, you know, they come in slightly below that. And then in separate material, they've said next generation or future satellites will have 1 terabit per second of downlink bandwidth. And that each Starship launch will launch 60 of these satellites. And so everyone kind of took this to mean both of those things would happen simultaneously. And so if we continue, if that were to happen right now, that's that red dot. If they were to continue on the current trajectory and keep launching satellites throughout this year, and then they had that next generation satellite at the end of the year, that would be that yellow dot. And so to us, that seemed, you know, it's like if that were true, then our model would, we think, undercount what the true potential is. So if that were true, that'd be great, amazing upside. We've actually been much more conservative, and we said, actually, we think these are referring to different satellites, and we're just going to stick with Wright's Law, and that's continuing upward towards that green dot.
So one thing is that, so, you know, we at Mach 33 always just took the assumption at face value that these V3s would be around 2,000 kilograms. And when Sam plotted this chart around one of the first times, I got, you know, he was so excited. He showed it to me on a screen share. And I was so convinced by this trend this way that I said to him, if the V3s, and I'm going to say this on public now, if the V3s came out at 4,000 kilograms, I would get a Wright's Law tattoo.
On his forehead, right?
On his forehead. I did say on my forehead, but I brought that back. I took that part back. I just didn't. I said I would get a Wright's Law tattoo.
But you know, as a veteran chart reader, I would say that if you dropped Starlink V1 as an outlier, because it was actually manufactured several years before and was not launched for a while, and there were some problems in the factory, and you start from Starlink 1.5, then the outlier is Starlink V2 mini optimized, and actually the red dot or even the yellow dot are very much in line. So I think the jury's still out on where we are until we see the first Starlink launch from, you know, a full-size optimized V3, V2, I mean.
That's a great point, Larry. I never really thought about that. You're right. There is definitely a trend here. And another idea I had is maybe we kind of see a bit of an acceleration if it is 2,000 kilograms. And one of the thoughts I had about these Starlink satellites is maybe Wright's Law doesn't perfectly represent improvement in satellite bandwidth and the amount of bandwidth it can deliver to the Earth. Now, one of the things that it's, you know, one of the simplest principles is that if you're sending a signal down to Earth from space, what's important is the size of the transmitting antenna. And so
And the height of the satellite.
Right.
I mean, the,
right, of course.
The altitude of the satellite.
Yeah. Right. And so the device that's receiving the signal, whether it's a dish, like a Starlink terminal or a phone, in order to get a stronger, more precise signal, you need a wider transmitting antenna.
Yep.
And so maybe part of this acceleration is that, you know, they're not only increasing in mass, but they're increasing in size. And part of the big step up between V2 and V3 is that we have Starship. So all of these had to fit on Falcon 9. And now all of a sudden you have a much larger fairing with Starship. And so part of the reason maybe we're seeing this acceleration is because of that. So that was another thought I had after I committed to getting
it. Yeah, that's a fair thought, Vlad. And the other thought is that I think V3 is targeted to a lower orbit. And so that is a factor as well. And that factor, you know, it kind of bends Wright's law because it's a non-technology thing. It's a functional thing. This is very good, but I think one of the issues that I have with doing this very, you know, this very significant amount of work around Starlink and betting all on Starlink, the two actual issues. One is you've taken no launch revenue into consideration. And the reason I raise that is that we've just learned that SpaceX are requesting to launch 79 starships from the Air Force base, the Air Force station in Florida. And what that means is they're looking at, you know, almost 80 launches a year for the Air Force or for the armed services. That's a huge amount of revenue, guys. That is not to be sniffed at. And you know that they're asking for 80 launches this year. There are going to be many more next year being requested. And they're talking about landing in barges. So I think we're going to see that Starship changes so many equations that the launch business suddenly, which is a tiny part of their business today, is going to significantly expand. I just raised that issue. The other side of that issue before we get off the Starlink revenue and the Starlink cash flow is, I think that we've done this all and assuming that Starlink is almost a monopoly, a global monopoly. And I'm not sure we factored in the potential for real competition, either for political purposes or for financial, you know, because financially somebody's found a better way to do it. I doubt that second part, but I certainly would factor in the first part to it. So I'm not sure whether the market is as expandable as we've estimated or is as flexible from a pricing point of view as we estimated. What do you say to that, guys?
Maybe before anyone goes, the one beauty about the Monte Carlo is, Larry, we have inputs that you can change. So like one of the inputs we have is Starlink performance. If you disagree with this slope, you can make it more aggressive. You can make it less aggressive. And then on the top line, we have a multiple that we apply to the revenue line item. And it says, okay, we think this is a close approximation to what we size the market as. And then it applies a multiple to account for uncertainties, price elasticity, et cetera. So if you think we're completely overshooting it, you can just cut it in half and say, okay, I want the multiple to range from 1/10 to 2/10. So I think that's the beauty about the Monte Carlo. And that's why it's great to get feedback because, you know, if you think we're too aggressive, then we can change it and then see the subsequent consequences.
I'm not proposing that you are too aggressive. I'm asking the question, have you factored that in? Have you given thought to competitive forces and the actual extent of the market, the, you know, the total TAM?
Yes. So, well, one, it's like, I'd say launch revenue is in the model, as is Starshield revenue. So both of those are in there and can be explored or tinkered with. And then on the competitive front, I think that's a very valid point, right? It's like there should be competitors. And you can imagine, you know, each continent likely wants to have some sort of constellation for their own national security needs, but should doesn't translate into reality. Yeah. You know, China certainly doing their own thing, and even in our addressable market, you know, we make it very clear. It's like you can lop off China and Russia if you don't think they'll partake, which I think is a very fair assumption. And yeah, it's like if there's a valid competitor, I think that would certainly shrink the portion of the addressable market that SpaceX can take. But at the same time, having said that, it's been 10 years. Not a single other company has a reusable rocket. And I think it is somewhat similar to Tesla, where, you know, Tesla did something that had not been done, and it was incredibly difficult. And everyone looked and they said, oh, Tesla did it. We can follow. And in fact, it's the opposite. This is, I think, very much a pull the ladder up behind you type of business, where SpaceX has 7,000 satellites orbiting, global coverage, high bandwidth, low latency. And you're going to come in, you're going to compete on whose rocket? First question, right? SpaceX has actually been extremely friendly launching competitors up, but you're at a higher cost then. So you launch, you know, your first 15 up there, and you've got non-global coverage with higher latency at worse pricing. And so it's like the ability to cross the chasm is, I think, growing, not shrinking, because SpaceX exists.
Yeah.
But interested in other people's opinions on that.
Aaron, do you think there's any rational competition on the horizon?
The most likely competition, I mean, this is, you know, who knows, but the most likely is probably the Kuiper, you know, group that they're, you know, from Amazon. They're launching, they have very capable satellites. From what I've heard, like, they're maybe not compared to B3, but maybe compared to B1, they're just as good, if not better, from like a performance perspective. So, and but to be fair, remember to Sam's point, you don't just need satellite, you need to build tons of satellites. You also need to be able to launch them, which that's the Blue Origin capability. You also need to build the terminals. And so, like, there's so many different infrastructural investments that need to be made. There's probably not all that many that can be straight up competitive. So it's definitely there. There's obviously opportunities, adjust the models as you see fit. And then the you mentioned something about, you know, launch as well. I'll add an additional wrinkle. That 80-79 launches is just from Cape Canaveral Space Force Station.
Right.
Space Force. That doesn't include, I think, the 30 for the Kennedy one, which is a launch pad just a little bit away, like a mile or two away from that same launch pad. So they actually can get up to 120. Now, these are forecasted, so it's not like they're going to launch them that many next year. The other component is, like, I think they need those launches to put fuel into orbit to go for Mars. They're going to need a lot of, you know, a lot of liquid oxygen being lofted into orbit there too. So between customers, fuel, and Starlink, I think they're going to have plenty of use for every single one of those slots over the next 5 years.
And we're kind of going a bit around the shop. Sorry, Larry, quickly, for anyone who doesn't know who's listening, to go to Mars, most of the work is getting the ship going to Mars and the fuel for the ship going to Mars to low Earth orbit. So literally just to get outside of the atmosphere is the large majority of the cost, because you not only have to launch the ship that's going to Mars, but you then have to launch five other ships in the short term that each individually refuel the one ship going to Mars. Now, as Starship gets bigger and bigger, that's going to go down to four refuels, something like that by our calculations. But yeah, going to Mars is expensive. But the hardest part is getting everything that you need for Mars to low Earth orbit. And one interesting thing about the Earth-Mars dynamic is that coming back from Mars to Earth is significantly cheaper. You don't need any refuels. You can hypothetically go, because gravity is roughly half, you can go from the surface of Mars straight to low Earth orbit back with one rocket without needing to refuel at all. So, you know, interesting thing that no one might have thought about is that there's almost like a gravity tax on Earth. And should there ever be an interplanetary economy, be significantly cheaper to be coming from Mars than it is to go to Mars.
Right. So, okay, I think we've covered somewhat the satellite business, right? Should we now turn to the future, or have we got more on the satellite to go?
Satellites are done.
Yes.
Satellites are done.
So one thing I would note is that, yeah, I've seen this pop up on X, people asking, is I don't think there was, maybe it's calculated in the launch capability, but we don't really spend a lot of time modeling point to point, which is something that's been mentioned and talked about in the past. Right. So again, so much variability. You don't really know where things are going, but I think a lot of that, the simulations allow for you to kind of have a little bit of wiggle room to say, hey, maybe there's more launch because there is a point to point economy that starts to come up. My hunch is that's mainly cargo for DOD early on, but what have you. We'll see where that actually lands. But ultimately, there's a lot of variability. Maybe launch is a bigger portion and satellites are a smaller portion. Starlink is a smaller portion of the consumer side because there's more competition. There's a lot of variability there. But I think, you know, ultimately, with all these simulations, you get pretty comfortable with the idea that the numbers probably still line up close to what we're thinking.
But the dollars we're talking about, the revenue and profits we're talking about all the way up to 2030 are predominantly communication, Starlink.
Yes.
And that means that the broad assumption is that Starlink is going to continue to dominate that world, and that world has the TAM to accommodate this tremendous growth of revenue and profitability, and that the profitability will not be squeezed by competitive forces all the way out to 2030. And so I think that's when I spoke earlier about some concerns I had or some areas of risk. I think that's the singular risk that, you know, we're going out 5 years and assuming that we're going to remain that competitive. On the other hand, I think, sorry.
Yeah, I would just, the pushback to that is if you're constraining to 5 years, again, all the infrastructure we're talking about, the ability to build as many terminals to launch as, I love Blue Origin. I got to see the launch. By the way, I live out there on the Cape. So the rockets shake my house. I'm looking forward to the sonic boom when Starlink lands, the ba-boom, sonic boom that I'll be hearing. But having said all that, right, 5 years is really not all that much time if people have to, you know, if Kuiper has to really accelerate to be able to compete at that scale. So what might make sense is there's little to no competition in this next 5 years, and then that competition starts to scale up more past 2030. If you were to, you know, make the argument kind of both ways.
I think that's fair, Aaron, and that's why, you know, when Sam asked me, do I believe in it, what do I think of the projections? I said it makes sense. There are risks, is all I'm pointing out, and I think the risks lie in that area. Now we can talk about Mars. Take us to Mars, Daniel.
Mars is a tricky place to get to, especially because you can only, you know, the fact that you can only get there once every 2 years complicates it even further, right? So it's like any delay could be a much bigger delay than would otherwise be the case. And then really the way we spoke about in the beginning is how we're modeling it. We're trying to do as simply as possible here. You take a Optimus robot, you assume a cost, a mass, and materials. You assume a productivity similar to a construction worker, and potentially that scales over time, right? So maybe not as good at first and then gets better. And they're going to build things that are useful on Mars. We're not expecting any cash flow because, as you said, very difficult to predict what that looks like, time frame of that, whatever. But if they are building something, there is a value to what they're building, and we're going to count that as book value.
So can I interject there, Sam? So one comment I've been getting a lot ever since we published this model, and I've had it a couple of times, is how in the hell are you valuing Mars in the trillions when clearly there's not going to be any profit? And I think that's where a lot of this breaks down in people's minds, that there can be a value to Mars before there is profit in being sent back to Earth. Or, and you know, a lot of people, when they think we're going to Mars, they think, oh, we're going to dig something out of the ground, we're going to send it back, we're going to sell it to terrestrial markets. But the reality is that there's probably a decade, couple decades, where we're just building the economic base to be able to do that, to even self-sustain what is on Mars, and then maybe in a half a century start shipping things back to Earth. But that doesn't mean that in these next couple decades, Mars isn't increasing in value. And you know, the analogy I had is, it might not be the best analogy, but you have your house, you have a backyard, and you have some cash, you have some money, you decide to dig a hole in your backyard and build a pool. All of a sudden, you're a lot less rich and you've burned a bunch of cash, but your house has increased in value, right? So I think it's a similar sort of thing that's going to be happening over the next decade or two, where SpaceX are going to be building the economic base of Mars. And that's what we're trying to capture in terms of Mars value in this model.
So if you had just simply taken all the cash from the launch and satellite business, or launch and communication business, and put it in the bank at X percent, or bought Bitcoin with it based upon, you know, the ARC's projections, you'd be in the same sort of position.
Well, except for you wouldn't be on Mars.
Except you wouldn't be on Mars. All right, I got it.
Well, yeah, well, like, let's not forget, like, this is a stated goal of Elon. So, like, this is something like this that we're looking at this chart here. It's going to happen to some extent, right? So, that, like, if there is mass there on being delivered to Mars on a regular basis, you know, if you can just see him, and again, this model really only takes into account SpaceX investing here. So,
right,
probably some others coming in at some point. I don't know when the trust is that, you know, the rest of the market feels that there's more to invest, or they start buying their own Optimi or other humanoid robots to compete, whatever. I mean, once that starts to happen, then this could get a lot more interesting. But right. It's like, it just depends. Like, do you believe Elon's going to plow back what they have, $15 billion in revenue coming in this year? Is he going to plow back several billion into this? I think he's made that pretty clear. And so, you know, we just take that on faith, effectively, that he's going to continue to do that until something changes his mind or something else happens, right?
Well, so this is the model that you've got, Vlad. You want to just give us a sense of it?
Yes, I'm happy to, high level. So, you know, the green line is the Mars book value, and it's very minimal at the beginning. And the red line is, it's a figurative number of Optimus robots that you could send, and that, you know, they represent a proxy for the productive capacity that you have on Mars each year. The reason you've got this squiggly line is because transfer window is roughly 2 years.
Yeah.
What we're saying is, in the base case, by 2040, with the cash that Starlink is generating, you'd have about 1 million Optimus robots, you know, a fleet of 1 million Optimus robots by 2040 on Mars. And that those Optimus robots would have produced, and are producing, but in that moment of time, have about $3.5 trillion in book value. That's what they produce. So in terms of productivity per Optimus robot, now this chart varies depending on the bull and bear case. You saw the distribution at the start. So there's large variability in the bear case, 500,000. In the bull case, almost 2 million robots.
Half a trillion, right? Half a trillion.
So I was talking about the robots there, but yeah, in the bull case, $4 trillion.
Got it.
In the bear case, $1.5 trillion. Yeah. What was it? I wanted to mention something. So one thing I wanted to say back to what you're saying, Larry, like, if you took all this cash flow and you put it in Bitcoin, that right now, that seems like that would be the wiser idea. But the reality is that we're not going to Mars because Elon wants to go to Mars, and we're not going to Mars because Mars is cool. The reason we're going to Mars is because it's a planet of untapped resources and a planet of untapped energy. So all of the energy we have on Earth, whether that's literally sunlight warming us up or the food we eat or whatever it is, it all comes from the sun. And on Earth, we can only capture so much of that energy. And so, you know, if humanity's growing, it's going to continue growing. Some people think that, you know, population is going to dwindle. And, you know, I've had some ideas that perhaps part of the reason that it's going to dwindle is because we're reaching the max amount of energy we can capture on Earth. So think about it this way. We're burning stuff for energy here, or we're trying to capture solar energy, or the energy is going to supporting our biosphere. Now, eventually, if you keep compounding the economy and you keep producing more and more stuff and more people are being born, you can imagine that we're going to reach a tipping point. And this is part of the reason I imagine Elon wants to go to Mars. It's not because it's a crazy adventure, but because there's a whole planet worth of resources and untapped energy that we can eventually learn to harness.
Well, I believe that there are a complex of reasons to go to Mars, but if we just look at what, you know, the civilizations have constantly done over the centuries, is we've constantly explored new boundaries, and this is just an exploration. This is just a continuation of it. Well, this has been an amazing study that you guys have done. I really believe that you know, the numbers are going to be in these ballparks. I think we can have a fairly high confidence in the earlier numbers, and we could play around with the model with these later numbers, and I'm going to do that, maybe even publish those, because I think it would be interesting. But I do think that this is the first time I've seen a really serious analysis of the potential for SpaceX in the coming five, and then looking out beyond to the 20 years. I hope I live to the next five. That would be enough for me to see how this comes out. Anybody want to add some last words before we close out?
I'll say, and then you feel free, anyone else, if you feel I'm totally off on these closing remarks. I would say everyone looks at SpaceX as the behemoth because they are, right? It's like $350 billion valuation. That's crazy, right? Biggest there is. They're launching skyscrapers. That's crazy. And yet we're really just at the beginning. They have 6 million Starlink subscribers. There's literally billions of people without access to the internet. So if you just look at that, that's crazy. If you look at the number of people with cellular connections to satellites, that's, you know, maybe like 0.15 to, I don't know, 0.5% penetrated.
I think you're much too high, Sam. I think it's
0.01. Yeah, it might be 0.01 something, yeah. You know, I think that's going to 100%. There's likely more competition as other people are already doing it. But we are so early in space as a story. And that's really what excites me so much here.
Very good. And Aaron, you want to close us out?
Yeah, I mean, I just echo what Sam's saying. You know, we're space bulls, if you will. And so, like, we see a lot of growth and opportunity. I would echo what you're saying, that most people aren't really thinking about SpaceX other than how it's this 350. They're looking backwards. So I think it's important for people to look forward. There's clearly a lot of opportunity. They have such a stranglehold on so many different layers of infrastructure and the ability to build things. We're probably missing an entire line item here that is going to be a revenue driver that, you know, they announce in a couple of years or they get a good idea. So, like, this is clearly an attempt. If there's any questions, obviously people want to ask serious questions. A lot of people will push back with, you know, we're crazy. That's fine. But if you have serious questions, we're happy to kind of interact and just reach out to us on X. Vlad and I know Sam and Daniel will try as well, but Vlad and I will try to, you know, respond and give thoughtful feedback.
Well, a particular thanks to the guys who really spent their time building these models, Daniel and Vlad. really great work. I'm very happy this has been done. I've been waiting to see something like this done. Now I can get my teeth into it and critique it. And we will be doing that in a relatively short period of time. But great job, guys. It really, this needed to be done. And I'm very happy to have you guys had presented. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having us on, Larry. See everyone on Mars.
To you, Larry.
Yeah.
Hopefully you guys give us an excuse to keep working on these space models, and we can chat with Larry about them again in the coming years.
Okay, everybody, don't log out until it tells you that it's downloaded. You should be seeing a download right now. I'm going to stop the recording.